From the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, this is NIH Research Radio. Welcome to episode 22 of NIH Research Radio, with news about the ongoing medical research here at the National Institutes of Health, the nation's medical research agency. I'm your host, Bill Schmalfeld. Well, here we are with the final podcast for 2006. Coming up for this edition, we'll go back in time to August, when I had a chance to sit down with Dr. Marston Linehan, a National Cancer Institute researcher, to talk about what's being done regarding research into the causes and treatments for kidney cancer. Wally Akinso has a story on how the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases has confirmed that medically performed circumcision can significantly lower the risk of adult males contracting HIV through heterosexual intercourse. The National Institute on Aging has a booklet available spelling out the dangers of hypothermia as well as how folks can avoid it. But first, there's good news to be found in a survey of 8th, 10th, and 12th graders. The survey, funded by the National Institute on Drug Abuse, finds that youngsters at these grade levels report a 23.2% decrease in their past month use of illicit drugs since 2001. That's coming up straight ahead on NIH Research Radio. If you have thyroid cancer, we here at the NIH think we have a lot to learn from you. If you're older than 16 and are planning thyroid surgery or your first radioactive iodine treatment, why not log on to clinicaltrials.gov? All study-related tests and procedures are provided for free. Check out clinicaltrials.gov or call 866-999-1116 for more information. NIH is a nonprofit government agency and part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. There's good news to be found in a survey of 8th, 10th, and 12th graders. The survey, funded by the National Institute on Drug Abuse, finds that youngsters at these grade levels report a 23.2% decrease in their past month use of illicit drugs since 2001. The 2006 Monitoring the Future survey indicates that such use among teens in these grades has dropped from 19.4% in 2001 to 14.9% in 2006. There was also good news about teen smoking, which is at an all-time low for all three grades, as well as alcohol consumption, which continues a downward trend. However, according to the survey, the abuse of prescription drugs remains at an unacceptably high level. Of significant concern is the finding that past year use of Vicodin has remained high in all three grades, with nearly 1 in 10 high school seniors using it in the past year. Dr. Nora Volkov, NIDA director, explained why the abuse of prescription drugs remains high in the face of declines in the use of illicit drugs.
I think it's a combination of factors, including the notion that perception-wise, there's been an increased awareness about potential harmful effects of marijuana. There is a misguided notion that prescription medications, because they are prescribed by physicians, are not as risky as other drugs of abuse. So that leads many young people to, and actually also adults, to take them with that false sense of safety, because prescription medication when abused are as dangerous as other illegal substances.
Since 1975, the Monitoring the Future survey has measured drug, alcohol, and cigarette use and related attitudes among adolescent students nationwide. The survey has been conducted since its inception by investigators at the University of Michigan.
When the general public thinks about cancer, folks like me, a layman, you know, we focus on the disease itself, how not to get it, what to do if we do get it. But then researchers at the National Cancer Institute look at the disease in other ways. For instance, kidney cancer. What's the genetic basis for kidney cancer? Do people inherit susceptibility to this kind of cancer? And at the forefront of this kind of research is my guest, Dr. Marston Linehan, chief of the urologic oncology branch at the NCI here at the National Institutes of Health. Is it true that people are genetically more susceptible to kidney cancer? kidney cancer than others?
Well, most cancers have both a inherited or hereditary form as well as a sporadic or non-inherited form of the cancer. And kidney cancer, like prostate cancer, breast cancer, has both an inherited as well as a non-inherited form.
So part of your job here at the NCI is to search for that genetic link to kidney cancer. What can you tell us about the research you and your colleagues have done here?
Well, we started out nearly 25 years ago now to identify the gene, we now note genes, for kidney cancer. Our hope at the time was that if we could identify and understand the genes that cause kidney cancer, that might lead us and other scientists to develop therapies to treat this disease.
What do we know about this gene mutation?
We started off in the early 1980s to identify the gene for kidney cancer, and it took us nearly 10 years to find the first kidney cancer gene called the VHL gene.
There was a certain amount of having to go from hospital to hospital, I understand.
Well, we studied families with kidney cancer and were able to use the power of genetics to identify the VHL kidney cancer gene.
What does VHL stand for?
VHL stands for von Hippel-Lindau. That's a hereditary cancer syndrome in which patients are at risk to develop a number of cancers, including kidney cancer.
Now that we've found this mutation, what can we do about it?
To begin with, in the families, we can now tell the family members who carries this gene, who's likely to develop kidney cancer in these families. We can tell children who are just born which children in the family are at risk to develop kidney cancer and which aren't. So we're very encouraged about that. But for us, the longer range goal is to understand how this gene works, how it causes cancer, in order to develop therapies for patients with kidney cancer.
Are we close to developing vaccines or other treatments based on this discovery?
Well, there's a lot of work looking at vaccines and immunologic therapy for kidney cancer, and there's been great progress in that area. Our focus is understanding the cancer gene and its pathway. And this work has led us, as well as other scientists, to understand this pathway. And the FDA approved two drugs in the past year that target this pathway in patients with kidney cancer. So we're very encouraged about that.
So by FDA approval, these drugs are available now?
Yes, they are.
Well, discoveries like this tend to have a ripple effect, where you find an application for a specific disease and then find that this also has applications in other areas. Is that the case with this research?
Yes. In other words, finding the gene for the inherited form of kidney cancer, it turned out this gene was also the gene for the non-inherited or sporadic, the common type of kidney cancer. So studying these families, these wonderful, brave people who were and are our partners in this work and who came here to the clinical center, to NIH, to be studied, this work has benefited those patients, but it also benefited so many other patients who have non-inherited kidney cancer.
It seems like for every time we answer a question, five more pop up, if not more. What are some of the more important unanswered questions that are still out there in this field?
When we started this work nearly 25 years ago, kidney cancer was thought to be a single disease. We now know that kidney cancer is not kidney cancer. It's not a single disease. It's a number of types of cancer that just happen to occur in the kidney. They have different histologic types, different types of kidney cancer. They react differently in patients. They have different clinical courses. They respond differently to therapy, and they're caused by different genes. So, in other words, kidney cancer, we used to think of as a single disease. We now know it's five or six diseases, at least. And some types of kidney cancer have as much in common with each other as breast cancer does with colon cancer. Our understanding of the genes that cause kidney cancer is that each different type is a different disease, and that potentially they're going to need different therapies targeting those pathways. So when we first identified the VHL kidney cancer gene, that was in 1993. We and others have been working on that gene and its pathway now for 13 years, and we've learned a lot, but we still have a lot to learn. We're encouraged about the progress that's been made, but we still have a long way to go. But we're very encouraged about the fact that these new medicines that were approved by the FDA this year have had response in a number of patients. So we're very encouraged about that. However, we need better agents that target the pathway even better than those agents, and combinations of drugs. So we have many, many things to do, but we're very encouraged about the progress of the work. The nation's biomedical investment in biomedical research is really paying off. Our work is because we focused on one disease, kidney cancer. However, we worked with colleagues from very different fields, from colleagues from the Genome Institute, colleagues who had genetics background, who we learned a lot from, colleagues from medical oncology, and all sorts of different backgrounds that enabled us to do this work. So the work that those people did, even though they weren't working on kidney cancer directly, has really benefited our work, and we think our work has helped them.
I always like to end an interview with this question. Is there anything you'd like to add?
I think it's just that we are very encouraged about the progress of the work, understanding cancer genes and developing therapies to target those pathways. I'm very optimistic about the future and hopeful that this type of work will lead to effective forms of therapy for every patient with kidney cancer.
Dr. Marston Linehan, Chief of the Urologic Oncology Branch here at the National Cancer Institute, thank you so much for spending a few minutes here with us on NIH Research Radio.
Thank you.
When we come back, Wally Akinso has some exciting news from the frontiers of HIV/AIDS research. That's next on NIH Research Radio.
No doubt about it, you're on your way to the top. You're young, you've got the education, you've got the talent. So what's the harm in a little celebrating? I mean, what could possibly go wrong?
Come on, tough guy, chug it, be a man.
Chug, 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 chug.
You are under arrest for disorderly conduct. You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you.
Please step out of the car, sir. I'm now going to proceed with a field sobriety test.
What could possibly go wrong? Plenty, that's what. The path to success is tough enough for young adults. Why make it even tougher? If alcohol is a problem for you or someone you know, visit www.niaaa.nih.gov for more information. Brought to you by this station and the National Institutes of Health, an agency of the United States Department of Health and Human Services.
In 2006 marked the 25th anniversary of the first reported cases of AIDS, so it's only fitting that we end this year with one such story, brought to us by our own Wally Akinso.
The National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases announced researchers have now confirmed that medically performed circumcision can significantly lower the risk of adult males contracting HIV through heterosexual intercourse. As a result, the NIAID has announced an early end to two clinical trials of adult male circumcisions. The trial in Kenya of 2,784 HIV-negative men showed a 53% reduction of HIV acquisition in circumcised men related to uncircumcised men, while a trial of 4,996 HIV-negative men in Uganda showed that HIV acquisition was reduced by 48% in circumcised men. Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the NIAID, explained the results.
So it looks now like, with all of the cautions that one needs to take to make sure that this is done in a medically supervised way so that you don't get any unnecessary complications, and that in fact people don't assume that if they're circumcised, therefore they're completely protected, which they're not. Taking those things into consideration, it appears now that circumcision will take its place among the effective ways of preventing HIV infection, but it must be done in accordance with other safe sex procedures. It can't be a standalone way to do it. But it's a very important advance because of what the results show, that you can actually, by a relatively simple, one-time, permanent intervention, you can actually cut the rate of HIV infection by over 50%.
Dr. Fauci said it is critical to emphasize that these clinical trials demonstrated that medical circumcision is safe and effective when the procedure is performed by medically trained professionals and when patients receive appropriate care during the healing period following surgery.
Obviously, you need to be sensitive to the particular cultures and traditions in the societies of the various countries. So in that regard, the World Health Organization is convening a meeting of health leaders from the region in sub-Saharan Africa to go over the data and to explain what the benefits and risks are of this procedure, and to leave it up to the authorities within given countries as to whether or not that they would proceed with or recommend that the males in their nation get circumcised for the purpose of avoiding avoiding HIV infection.
Dr. Fauci said researchers have noted significant variations in HIV prevalence that seemed, at least in certain African and Asian countries, to be associated with the levels of male circumcision in the community. According to Dr. Fauci, in areas where circumcision is common, HIV prevalence tends to be lower. Conversely, areas of higher HIV prevalence overlapped with regions where male circumcision is not commonly practiced. This is Wally Akinso at the National Institutes of Health, Bethesda, Maryland.
Well, there's no getting around it. Winter is upon us. And that means, in many parts of the country, time to gear up to stay warm. As folks get older, they are more and more susceptible to a condition known as hypothermia. Now, the National Institute on Aging has a booklet available spelling out the dangers of hypothermia, as well as how folks can avoid it. According to Dr. Jack M. Guralnick, acting chief of the Laboratory of Epidemiology, Demography, and Biometry at the NIA.
This booklet points out that hypothermia, which is loss of body temperature, is potentially quite a dangerous condition in older people in the wintertime. It gives advice on how to recognize hypothermia and advice on how to deal with it if you believe that someone that you know has it.
Hypothermia occurs when a person's body temperature drops below 95 degrees Fahrenheit because of exposure to cold, either indoors or outside. Low body temperature can cause heart attack, kidney problems, liver damage, and sometimes even death. According to the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, about 600 people in the United States, half of them age 65 or older, die from hypothermia each year.
Everybody is actually susceptible to hypothermia if the temperature gets cold enough. So it's both an environmental situation where people may have houses that are drafty and can get quite cold, keeping the thermostat down, or spending too long out of doors without proper clothing, especially on windy days. There are some medical conditions that make people more susceptible to hypothermia, conditions such as stroke, Parkinson's disease, and certain medications also can make people more susceptible.
The booklet is called Stay Safe in Cold Weather. It's written in plain language and incorporates colorful graphic elements and other features to help readers understand the content. In creating the new booklet, the NIA publications team talked with older adults and considered the needs of people with limited reading skills. To order free copies or for more information about Stay Safe in Cold Weather and other NIA publications, visit the NIA website at www.nia.nih.gov or call 800-222-2225. Bulk orders are welcome. And with that, we come to the end of this episode of NIH Research Radio. Please join us on Friday, January 12th, when episode 23 of NIH Research Radio will be available for download. These stories are also available on the NIH Radio News Service website. That's www.nih.gov/news/radio. Our daily 60-second feature, NIH Health Matters, is heard on nearly 1,000 radio stations nationwide, as well as on XM Satellite Radio and on the HealthStar Radio Network. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please drop me a line. The info is right there on the podcast webpage. If we use your comment, we'll send you something nice from the NIH gift shop. That email address is schmalfew@od.nih.gov. Once again, that email address, schmalfew@od.nih.gov. I'm your host, Bill Schmalfeld. NIH Research Radio is a presentation of the NIH Radio News Service, part of the News Media Branch, Office of Communications and Public Liaison, and the Office of the Director at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, an agency of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.